The following program is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. Support for the distribution of this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR Arts and Performance Fund. Contributors include the National Endowment for the Arts, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and Bell Atlantic. The Nature of Music series is produced by Garuda Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Garuda Productions, The Nature of Music. Listen, there's two melodies tangled up here. Did you hear them? Don't feel bad. It's almost impossible. Well, the tunes are tunes you know. Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and Frère Jacques. Here it is again. You see, the two melodies are mixed up so close together that they're hard to separate. But as you move them apart, they're a lot easier to recognize. Interesting, isn't it? You've just tried an experiment that was designed by a psychologist at the University of Texas. He's working on one answer to the question we're asking in this program. How do we hear and make sense out of musical sounds? I'm Paul Anthony, and this is The Nature of Music. Our subject in this program, music and the brain. Everyone has one, but nobody knows much about it. But what we do know is that the brain controls the way we create, perform, and hear music. Now, recently, scientists from many disciplines are finding new answers to questions like, what is so human about music making? Does a musical prodigy think differently from other musicians? And how does your child progress from babbles to Old MacDonald Had a Farm? No one person can explain it all, but we can get a more complete understanding of these questions by asking leading musicians and scholars. In New York City, trumpet virtuoso Wynton Marsalis reveals the workings of an extraordinary musical mind. At UCLA School of Medicine, Dr. John Mazziata injects a subject with radioactive isotopes to trace the response of the brain to music. And in San Diego, Professor Diana Deutsch offers surprising evidence that we may hear music differently from one another because of the way our brains are wired up at birth. But first, a Harvard researcher has looked to the animal kingdom for some insight into how humans begin to sing.
One might assume that since primates, like chimpanzees, are much closer to human beings genetically than any other species, that you would look there for evidence of musical-type capacities. But in fact, the search for analogs to human music takes us much more rapidly to birdsong than it does to any kind of vocalization on the part of primates.
Howard Gardner is a neuropsychologist at Harvard University. His research shows that young birds and young children go through the same three stages in learning to sing. Both begin by making random, incomprehensible sounds, babbles and chirps. In the second stage, infants and young birds explore fragments from songs they hear around them. Finally, complete songs of the species are learned.
I think it's important not to push the analogy too far, because to put it very simply, every bird ultimately has to achieve a certain target, namely the songs that are sung by the rest of its species. Human beings also learn the songs of their culture, but we have the options to go beyond those and to make up new songs.
In his studies of children, Gardner found that something very important happens about the end of the first year.
The child stops babbling and begins to produce both distinct language sounds, you know, mama, papa, things like that, and much more distinct musical sounds.
Gardner says that children invent spontaneous songs and also begin to produce bits of familiar ones.
And what happens between the age of 1.5 and 4, roughly speaking, is that the spontaneous song slowly goes underground, and what emerges instead are more and better faithful copies of the songs that the child hears around them.
Gardner studies middle-class American children. But in some cultures around the world, children are expected to learn music more quickly. In a traditional West African village, by the time the baby can walk, he or she begins playing games and singing songs with other children in the village. As early as age 3 or 4, the child begins casually learning adult instruments and songs. By age 5, the child really has a substantial repertoire of songs. Because music is an integral part of learning and growing up in a West African village, a child there learns music more quickly than Gardner's middle-class American child. London, 1765. Philosopher Daines Barrington writes to the Royal Society an account of a very remarkable young musician, Johannes Chrysostomus Wolfgangus Theophilus Mozart.
He played a difficult lesson which he had finished a day or two before. His execution was amazing, considering that his little fingers could scarcely reach a fifth on the harpsichord. His astonishing readiness, however, did not arise merely from great practice. He had a thorough knowledge of the fundamental principles of composition. He was also a great master of modulation, and his transitions from one key to another were excessively natural and judicious. He practiced in this manner for a considerable time with an handkerchief over the keys of the harpsichord.
Mozart probably had as good a musical brain as the world has ever seen, but it was necessary not only for him to have that brain, but also to couple it to the music of his time, Western classical music. We don't know whether if he lived in India or in Africa, whether his kind of musical mind would have been able to deal with those kinds of musics, and to live in a society which recognized prodigies, which encouraged them, which had patrons, which commissioned music, and that kind of thing.
Once the extraordinary musician gets public recognition, Gardner says, true musical genius is exhibited further in certain performers like jazz trumpeter Wynton Marsalis.
Now, the Wynton Marsalis example, and also individuals like Yo-Yo Ma, these are individuals who are already at the top of their chosen field and could probably crest in that position for a long time. But I think part of being a creative individual is that you continuously pose new kinds of challenges to yourself. You undertake new risks because that makes you a fuller kind of performer and a fuller human being.
I find that the more you know and the more that you can examine in other idioms will can only help in your own idiom. It's important for me that right now I'm reading some Thomas Mann. I'm trying to just read and I'm going to start studying some Picasso. I'm just going to try to get a more well-rounded view of what other artists have thought.
And I think you have a case there where he didn't have to begin to, you know, play trumpet concerti, right? I mean, nobody made him do that. But I think he saw that as part of his growth as a human being to undertake a new area which he knew was there.
I've known people that actually had a greater aptitude for playing trumpet than I have. But the thing is, I'm a very consistent worker, and I figure out what the problems are. And then all of my goals lead me in the direction of solving it.
Jazz trumpet virtuoso Wynton Marsalis performing the Haydn Trumpet Concerto. Great sound, isn't it? And coming from a jazz musician, Wynton Marsalis, the beautiful thing about this Haydn performance is that it is a jazz musician first, bringing the tone and sound that only Winton can bring to the thing really kind of brings it alive for me, and I really enjoy it as a jazzophile. And I agree with Howard Gardner's idea that a true musical genius is like an explorer who keeps on searching for new lands to discover. At least, well, that's one kind of genius. But there are other kinds. Mozart was a genius, but he didn't contribute anything new to musical theory. He didn't engage in radical experiments, didn't contribute anything particularly new to structures or forms of expression. He did the same kind of thing other composers were doing of his time, but he did it more easily and more beautifully. I think part of the reason, the explanation for the Mozart phenomenon, is the way his father encouraged him when he was a child. Part of the explanation, too, probably the biggest part, must be found, though, in his natural equipment, in his brain. So in this program, we're asking questions about how our brains make sense out of musical sounds, whatever they may be. Remember that? It's the experiment designed by Professor Jay Dowling, a University of Texas psychologist. We heard it at the beginning of the program. Dowling says this experiment shows something about the way we gather and interpret information. We're more likely to hear something or notice it if we already know something about it. Once we know the two melodies are Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and Frère Jacques, we can hear them both, right? Even though they're tangled up so tightly together. Jay Dowling is just one of many experimental psychologists who conduct lab experiments to learn more about music and the brain. Later in this program, we'll hear from another researcher who brings up the question of why we don't sing like dolphins, and from a medical doctor at UCLA who takes brain scans that show parts of the brain are responding to musical tones. But first, there's a psychologist in San Diego who's doing some very interesting work. Her name is Diana Deutsch. Now, I've tried some of her experiments and was pretty surprised at what I heard. For example, I always thought that we all hear things the same way. But do we?
The answer is very surprising. And here, I would like to play some demonstrations. I would play, say, C followed by F sharp and ask people, what do they hear? If you have a group of people sitting listening to this, you'll find that some of them will say, oh, it's clearly ascending, and others will say, oh, it's clearly descending.
Okay, here's what I heard. Up, down, up, down. Now, you might have heard it differently. In fact, Dr. Deutsch found that if you play these examples for any group of people, and musicians, by the way, are no exception, you practically have fist fights between folks who insist they heard it one way or another.
Paul, it went up, down, down, up. Not the way you said it.
Oh, come on.
No, I'm sorry.
It went up, down, up, down.
No, up, down, down, up.
I think our producer's tone deaf in there. It didn't go that way. Well, if that's what she heard, we do hear it differently then. That's the point of this experiment, all right? But wait. There's still another experiment Diana Deutsch uses to demonstrate how people really do hear differently from each other. She plays this melody in your left ear. At the same time, she plays this melody in your right ear. Now, here's the amazing part. When you hear the two played together, now, in my right ear, I heard what appeared to be lower tones. And in my left ear, I heard higher-pitched melodies. But I guess different people hear different things. For example, I happen to be left-handed. Now, most right-handed people insist they hear all the high tones in their right ear, all the dee, 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 and all the lower tones in their left ear, the dun, 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 dun. Singing is not my game. What's more, when they switch their headphones around, right to left, left to right, they still hear the high tones in the right ear and the low tones in the left ear. Let me switch my headphones and give that a try, okay? Here we go. That's amazing. I heard them switched around. I switched the headphones around, and I heard the high tones in the right ear this time and the low tones in the left ear. Well, I don't know. Professor Deutsch calls this experiment the scale illusion.
Well, one of the facts about music perception that this type of illusion represents is that there are huge individual differences between listeners and how music is perceived. And in the case of the scale illusion, these differences correlate with handedness.
We already know that most right-handers hear the high tones in the right ear, low tones in the left ear. Left-handers aren't that consistent, and I guess I proved that, huh? Professor Deutsch found subjects reporting a variety of other responses. A few heard the high tones in the left ear, low tones in the right, and when the headphones were reversed, some heard a switch in the apparent location of the tones, and that's exactly what happened to me. Still others reported hearing only the high tones in a pattern that went up and down over and over again. So what is Professor Deutsch trying to prove with all this?
It's generally assumed that when we hear a piece of music, we hear it either well or we hear it poorly, and we either catch all of it or we catch some of it, and so on. But what needs to be recognized is that we really hear music differently from each other.
In other words, what we hear, how we hear music, is determined by how our individual brains are wired up?
Yes, I'm talking about hardwired connections. Absolutely. I'm not talking about aesthetics. I'm not talking about something judgmental, something that we can argue about on the basis of a common percept. I'm talking about literally hearing the music differently and in a way that's outside our control.
My name is John Mazziata, and I'm Associate Professor of Neurology and Radiology at UCLA School of Medicine.
What is the PET scan?
Well, PET scanning is a technique where we can make images of what the brain is doing. We use certain radioactive compounds in very trace amounts, and these compounds measure certain key processes in the brain.
Okay. Can you tell me what happens when the subject shows up for the PET scan experiment?
Well, typically the description of what will go on is given to them, and then they arrive and are shown in detail the devices and the equipment that will be part of the study.
Right now you're standing three stories underground. This facility is set up to produce very short-lived radioisotopes, which will be incorporated into radioactive pharmaceuticals, which will be injected into patients upstairs in scanning rooms in order to aid in new types of diagnosis.
Movement is back for the bone scan.
Okay, just slide right on back here. That's it.
They then are seated or lie down on a bed and have headphones placed. They're blindfolded so that visual stimulation doesn't make more complicated the final results. And then we begin to play for them the sequence of notes or other types of stimuli that we might provide. During that period of time, when they're listening, they're injected with a compound that is an analog of table sugar, it's glucose, and it distributes in the brain in proportion to the area's activity. This goes on for about 30 minutes, at which point we put them in a scanner that makes images of the brain. It's a large device with a bed that the subject lies on. It's has the appearance of an oversized washing machine with the head in an opening in the center of the machine, and this moves around them, it doesn't touch them. And at the end of about 30 to 60 minutes, a series of images or pictures come out.
What is the physical result of all this? We get pictures, as you mentioned before.
This is what the scanner does. It electronically divides up the brain into slices, makes these images, projects them onto a TV monitor, and then color codes them red might indicate higher values of metabolism and therefore greater participation of that region in a given task.
What did you discover when you put them through this test?
In these studies, this being a nonverbal task, we expected the non-dominant hemisphere, the right hemisphere in most right-handed individuals, as most of these, as all of these subjects were, would be predominantly involved in doing this task. And in fact, in the majority of these subjects, it was the right hemisphere that was most consistently involved and involved to a degree of greater extent than the left hemisphere.
Okay. Why would one hemisphere be dominant over another? Any particular reason for that?
No, I think that's a real curiosity of the brain. Typically, organs in the body that are paired, like kidneys and adrenal glands and things of this sort, and eyes, are quite identical. But the brain may be really unique to this. And why that is, how it develops, and the basis for it is something that has become a very active area of interest, but as yet an area of pretty limited insight.
جورا استر جدا میو شوق استر نظر.
Most musical cultures have scales, not the same scales, but discrete pitch changes. Why? Why don't we make music like the dolphins' sound? They go up and down. I think that this is due to some feature in our musical processing system, or the way our brain works.
The program that's already written.
Exactly. That the program or the hardware that's already there and wired, pre-wired.
That's Juan Roederer, director of the Geophysical Institute in Fairbanks, Alaska. He's an internationally known space physicist, but he's also author of a standard textbook on the psychoacoustics of music.
Music is a natural drive that motivates humans from birth on to listen to simple sounds as a training exercise. I always liken it to a cat that plays with an object that has nothing to do with food. You can roll a ball and a cat or a dog will play. Why? To train in hunting, skilled movement, and all that which has to be acquired for survival. So when the mother sings to the baby and the baby looks and quiets down, the brain of that baby says, aha, stop crying, listen. Listen to that simple ah sound. And this is a drive that persists, fortunately, for the rest of our lives.
Juan Roederer, a space physicist, and one explorer in the quest to understand music and the brain. Thanks to Roederer and to all the other contributors to this program, psychologists Howard Gardner, Diana Deutsch, and Jay Dowling, and to medical researcher John Mazziata. These all represent a modern, scientific point of view. To get a completely different perspective on the question of right versus left brain, we went to Hopi land in north central Arizona. In the ancient Hopi story of creation, we found an answer more mysterious, yet strangely similar to the theories of our modern scientists.
The first act of the creator, Daioa, was to make Xotiknung, who created old spider woman, to be his helper, and said to her, "We see no joyful movement or sound. What is life without sound and movement? You have been given the power to help us create this life and the knowledge, wisdom, and love to bless all the beings you create. Following his instructions, old Spider Woman took some earth, mixed it with some saliva, and molded it into two beings. Then she covered them with a cape made of white substance, which was creative wisdom, and sang the creation song over them. When she uncovered them, the twins sat up and asked, "Who are we? Why are we here?" To the one on the right, old Spider Woman said, "You are Pikanghuya. Go now around all the world and put your hands upon the earth so that it will become fully solidified." To the one on the left, old Spider Woman said, "You are Palingahuya. Go about all the world and send out sound so that it may be heard throughout all the land. When this is heard, you will also be known as Echo, for all sound echoes the Creator." Pikanghuya traveled throughout the earth and solidified the higher reaches into great mountains, while the lower reaches he made firm but still pliable enough to be used by those beings to be placed upon it and who would call it their mother. Palingahuya traveled throughout the earth and sounded out his call. All the vibratory centers along the earth's axis from pole to pole resounded his call. The whole earth trembled. The universe quivered in tune. Thus he made the whole world an instrument of sound, and sound an instrument for carrying messages, resounding praise to the Creator of all.
The Hopi Story of Creation, recited by Michael Lamata-Wima. If you'd like a free program guide to the Nature of Music series and information on how to order a cassette or a transcript of this program on Music and the Brain, write to The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Here's that address again. The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Special thanks to people who helped put this program together in one way or another. Harold Cannon, Dane Harwood, Joe McClellan, radio station KNAU in Flagstaff, Arizona, and to the Nuclear Medicine Department at the National Institutes of Health. This program on Music and the Brain is written and produced for Garuda Productions by Carl Signell and Deborah Jane Lamberton. Audio engineering and technical supervision is by Paul Blakemore. Michael Wilpers is the research assistant. And the executive producer for the Nature of Music series is Dr. Carl Signell. Music and the Brain was funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund and by the L.J. and Mary C. Skaggs Foundation. I'm Paul Anthony. This is NPR, National Public Radio.